I think it's safe to say that as web professionals, this is a topic that we all struggle with at some point in time, probably don't understand as well as we should. So today we have Scott Linger from Duke Law School, who's going to talk about understanding fair use.
Good morning. I'm going to begin with sort of a illustration from business that can kind of define popular understanding of fair use. It's popular in business to sort of view the consumer under two different sorts of ideas. There's fear and greed are sort of understood as the two primary reasons why consumers make decisions from a business perspective. And I think the same tends to hold true in our application of fair use in higher education. So there's those that aren't sure whether they're using something that would fall under fair use, and they're afraid of litigation, they're afraid of using something incorrectly, so they either pay the fees and have the rights secured, or they just don't use it. Then on the other end of the spectrum, there's those that assume, since their domain ends in .edu, that they're free to do whatever they want. And I think both of those are a little mistaken. And so what I hope to do this morning is just look at some ways that we can sort of navigate through the ambiguity of fair use and determine how we can best apply it in instances of higher education. So we're going to look at fair use and its relationship to copyright law, criteria for determining fair use, implications for web developers in higher education, some alternatives, and then I'll leave you with some resources both for fair use and for finding other non-copyright materials. So copyright law. Since 1989, in accordance with the International Berne Convention, copyright in the United States is automatic and does not require any registration fee or documentation. So what this means is if you see content available online that you want to use, it's probably copyright, whether or not it says so. So if you had a blog you want to use, some content from that blog, you scroll down, no copyright in the footer, hey, let's use it. Copyright. And the reason for this is there's an international law that defines things this way, and for a long time the U.S. Wasn't interested in joining that convention simply because they wanted to enforce registration for items to be copyright, but since 1989 that's no longer the case, so it's best to, if you're unsure, assume that whatever you're looking at is copyright. And also, if you're a creator, you don't have to worry about how to copyright your product. Once you create it, it is. One issue, though, is prior to 1989, the Berne Convention in the U.S. is not retroactive. So works created previously may fall under a number of different sort of copyright laws and whatnot. And I'm not going to really go into those, but there's several charts available online that sort of go through how copyright has evolved over time, and one of those is listed there, but a Google search will turn up quite a few of those. So how does fair use relate to copyright law? Both copyright law and fair use have the same goal, and that is to further creativity and further knowledge. And so what fair use does is if the commercial interests of protecting ideas and protecting creativity become too strong, then fair use can come in and sort of balance those out so that, there's a balance there and one doesn't take too much presence over the other. So the quote here, to avoid rigid application of the copyright statute when, on occasion, it would stifle the very creativity which that law is designed to foster. That's quoted from the Sony versus Bleem case, and it's kind of become, it's been used elsewhere in laws that have built on that, is just to sort of define very briefly what the purpose of fair use is to do. So, in essence, fair use involves the public right to limited use of copyright material without permission. So the two key points there are that it's our right as Americans to be able to use this content for the purposes listed below, and that also we get to do so without permission. So someone asked previously in the last session, if someone has a disclaimer on their site that says, this is the author's work, you can reuse it, well, fair use says that you don't need their permission. So there you go. So the question, though, is how do we apply fair use? How do we understand it? And sort of that there's a tendency to want to see it as a definition where we can, you know, just go through a checklist and say yes, no, okay, this is fair use, this isn't. But in actuality, I think that it's much more of a philosophy. And I think there's a lot of benefits to that. The main one being that you're not going to be as limited to what a definition would restrict you to. And a philosophy, by not defining things, allows it to be more ambiguous and, in a way, can give you a lot more freedom. And you can kind of see the results of these two if you compare fair use with the 1990 Teach Act. Not sure how many are familiar with that, but it's primarily for teachers, so they wouldn't be stuck under the ambiguity of fair use. And it's kind of like a checklist. So you have to say how many people are in the course, how many handouts you're making, and each one of those is defined. But it became so defined that teachers rarely use it because it's, you know, generally falls outside of what they really want to use in the classroom. So rather than produce a specific but limited set of guidelines, the fair use doctrine gives four broadly defined factors for determining whether something's fair use. And they're often referred to as the four prongs. And you'll see, in most cases arguing fair use, you'll see the court sort of addressing each one of these items and saying where they believe the issue falls. So purpose and character. Two main ideas here. Is the use transformative or is it educational? Transformative basically means, are you taking the original work and adding to or building on it? So you wouldn't want to just take, you know, a blog article, copy and paste it into your blog. You'd want to, you know, include parts of that and build on it and add to it. However, if you were using it in a classroom, you may want to just keep it as is and use it to further education. And I'm going to put, there's a court case that is sort of pivoted on this issue that I'm going to add to each one of these items. And I'm not really going to go into those because they don't really apply to academic settings per se. But if you want to further research or look at those, they'll be available on the slides that you can download. This instance has a little application. Kinko's was basically taken to court for making course packets. And the court said, your course packets have a commercial interest, and therefore it's not a fair use. The nature. What type of work is being used? Is it published or unpublished? Is it factual or creative? So, published or unpublished, the issue with that is if it's not published, then you may be inhibiting the sort of notoriety or even the commercial incentive for the original creator to publish the work. So generally, published works are more often favored than if you happen across something not published. And you might be going, well, since everything's copyright when it's created, what makes something published? Well, that'd refer to like journal articles or magazine type pieces where it's formally presented to the public. And then factual creative, factual refers to like if something's historical or if it's just general knowledge. You kind of can't copyright that. In most instances, people are trying to change that. So those are usually more favored than if something is, you know, the result of or someone's creative work. Amount and substantiability refers to how much of the original work you're reusing. The big question that the courts will look at is, are you taking the heart of the work? So it's not just that, you know, it's a book, you're taking 10 pages out of a 100-page book, but you could very well only take a paragraph, but if it's the primary quote of the person who's being, you know, critiqued in this book, then you may have a harder fair use case than if you took two chapters that were just sort of introductory material. And then lastly, the effect on the original work's value. So is your reuse inhibiting the current or even a future potential market for the original work? In this case, I will talk about Aribasoft is a company, it's a search engine, and what they were doing is taking images and photographs and creating thumbnails of those so you could you know, see what the search results returned, and then they'd give a link to the actual item. And a photographer took him to court and said, you can't rescale my work and, you know, use it for your commercial interest. And the court said in this instance that it was all right because they were making the image so small that it really didn't have a lot of use outside of providing information on what the photograph was. They were also linking to the original work, and they also had a commercial interest that wasn't necessarily competing with the original photograph. So they weren't selling it as stock photography, they were making a search engine. However, here comes the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and its lovely digital rights management. And here's where there's a lot of tension currently with fair use. Basically, the problem is, as part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's created laws protecting the anti-circumvention methods of some of our electronic work. So the best example is DVDs, which are encrypted. And to copy a DVD or copy a clip from a DVD, you have to circumvent the DVD's encryption. And so this Copyright Act kind of tried to address some of these issues that have come about with the electronic age, that whereas before, you could copy work from a book, but it was a lot harder to actually physically copy the book, whereas now you could take a CD, physically copy the entire CD and have a perfect replication of it. So some different, it kind of changed the playing field a little bit, and this sought to address some of that. However, the problem is fair use would tend to argue that you should be able to reuse any work as your right, without permission, for, you know, a variety of purposes, whereas the digital rights management is now saying, well, except in the case of electronic materials where no longer can you do that. And so one of the popular solutions that the court has tried to suggest is this horse and buggy method, which is basically, while you can't copy a DVD directly because you'd be circumventing DRM, you can take your camcorder, set it up in front of your television, and record whatever's on the TV and use that. And aside from just kind of being weird, you know, it doesn't really address some of the software issues related to that. So if you wanted to look at source code, you couldn't run a program and videotape it to see what the source code was doing. You'd actually have to, you know, dig into whatever the program was. There's similar instances where you'd want to do things like that in a web setting. So it doesn't really address the issue entirely. And so this whole argument is very much in debate. There's lawyers arguing for both sides. And it's something to watch. And then the little asterisk there, the Register of Copyrights has repeatedly been requested to add an exception to fair use for these circumvention methods, but they have not yet addressed that issue. So, fair use in the real world, what can we take from these four prongs, and, you know, how do we understand that to how we use fair use? Educational applications of fair use are favored. So, basically a way to illustrate that is, I had a really hard time finding any cases whatsoever where an institution was taken to court over a fair use argument. Part of that could be because companies don't want to be seen as taking a university, you know, devoted to scholarship and knowledge to court over money. So it's kind of helpful. Educational issues are unlikely to be pursued through litigation. There you go. Non-profit education institutions may be offered statutory damages exceptions. So, you know, even if a corporation does take you to court, if you can prove that whoever reused the content tried to make sure they were falling under fair use and just made a mistake, the court can offer a statutory damage exception to relieve your institution of having to pay damages, which, you know, further makes it, you know, not very helpful for a company to really take you to court, because there's no financial incentive, there's severe marketing disadvantages to it. So there's sort of this bubble of protection around universities that, you know, if you have worry or fear, may give you comfort. And then lastly, the definition of fair use is intentionally ambiguous to further help you in, you know, arguing a case. But on the other hand, there's no clear guidelines for fair use, so there is, you know, with it, ambiguity. Litigation can be expensive, so if you're not given the statutory damages exception, your school could be hurting. And publisher contracts can override your right to fair use. So if one of your faculty members publishes in, like, a magazine or something, they may have initiated a contract with that magazine that limits their ability to reuse that piece elsewhere, even if they created it. And that's something we run into quite a bit. And then again, the definition is intentionally ambiguous, so there's not a lot of certainty with fair use. And there's the Copyright Clearance Center, which is a sort of web-based management service. Basically, what they do is take items you want to use, and for a nominal fee, they'll clear the rights to it so that you have no worry about whether it falls under fair use. The problem with this is they pretty much disregard even determining if your use would fall under fair use, and just find it easier to just charge you a fee. And one area where this is particularly coming up is where we use it, is with Blackboard, which is a course management CMS. And in version 7, they've introduced a copyright clearance module where the faculty member can upload a document, you know, click on this module, fill in some information about it, send it to the Copyright Clearance Center. The Clearance Center looks it over, contacts the publisher, certifies all the rights, and then charges your school directly. So you don't have to worry about, you know, paying out of your pocket or these other things, and it makes it really easy, but it also doesn't really take into consideration the fact that you might have a legal right to use it in the first place without paying anything. So I see that as sort of a problem. What we're going to look at here are just some sort of scenarios I've kind of created that will illustrate how some of these issues can play out in different ways that we might run into this at our jobs. Commercially published work. A faculty member is featured in a prominent publication which requires a fee-based membership in order to log in and view the article. In light of this, the faculty member posts a scanned copy of the print article on their personal website. So here, the fact that it's a fee-based membership isn't really an issue. It's copyright either way, so whether or not there's a fee doesn't really have anything to do with whether it falls under fair use. Same with login. I know a lot of times we think that if we password protect something or hide it behind, you know, a login feature, that, you know, it's more protected or more for use, but it's generally not the case. We'll look at an example later on where that could be an issue, or why you'd want to do that. Doesn't really matter how you came across the item, or whether it's, you know, scanned, or it's a, you know, just copied and pasted or whatever. With the exception, of course, of anti-circumvention methods of acquiring, which is still a point of tension that we'll also get into later. The issue here would really be the nature of their personal website. If it's a site that's sort of, you know, is revenue generating, they're trying to promote a book or they're speaking or something, and it's more of a commercial interest, they may have a harder time arguing for fair use, whereas if their personal site is, you know, just to further knowledge or provide information, then they'd have a reasonable fair use argument. And again, we've got the contract publisher issues, and the contracts will override fair use, and it's one of the few things that can trump it. And it would just trump it for the creator. It doesn't mean that someone created an article, it was in a magazine, they have a contract, but you don't necessarily have one with the magazine. So that's how you'd want to think about that. Video clips. A 4-minute video clip from Fight Club is posted on a course website for the purpose of studying the film's perspective on gender. The website is publicly available, though intended for students enrolled in the course Gender and Western Society or other students studying in the same field, DRM protection was circumvented in order to format and post the video clip. So there's quite a few issues going on with this case. The fact that it was a 4-minute clip would make a fairly good argument for fair use. It would depend on what that clip was. If it was sort of the climax of the movie, you might have a harder time arguing for using that, although it's also a film course, so maybe that was important to the academic study of the film in of itself. The fact that it is a course is a great argument for fair use. The fact that it's publicly available, again, not as much of an issue. It could come up if, you know, the publisher could argue that by having this clip available, you're preventing people from buying the movie. And that would, you know, obviously depend on the clip and be kind of a hard case to prove, I think. But you've got this issue of digital rights management that you've circumvented to post this clip on your site, which is a tension we've talked about already. And so we've got Billy's bio. An excerpt of 10 pages from Bill Clinton's autobiography, My Life, is included in the book The Dayton Peace Accords, Public Policy Towards the 21st Century. The latter book is available for free download on the internet under a Creative Commons attribution license. Okay, so here we have the fact that it's a rather brief excerpt. 10 pages out of a book isn't that much. You'd want to look at whether those 10 pages are the heart of the work, so what exactly they're taking. There's sort of a related case regarding President Ford's letters concerning exoneration of President Nixon, and they were supposed to be published by one magazine, and another one beat him to it and published the letters beforehand, and it went to court and they said, well, it's fair use because it's a historic letter. And the court said, well, it's historic, but you know, this other newspaper worked out rights with President Ford to release those first, and since it hasn't yet been published, and because you're severely impeding on their commercial interest in, you know, providing these to the public initially, that they did not do well in their case. The fact that this is available for free download argues for an academic purpose of it because you're not commercially benefiting from it. On the other hand, it could also impact the commercial aspects of the autobiography. And then the Creative Commons license, really not an issue here. The issue is more copyright, and Creative Commons is more of an addition to what a copyright would be, but doesn't really negate your ability to apply fair use. Billboard BitTorrents. Billboard's top 10 pop songs of 2005, downloaded from BitTorrents, are stored on a password-protected site accessible only to students enrolled in the course Adolescence and Popular Culture. First off, if you have downloaded these as BitTorrents, the assumption would be that you didn't pay for them. They're most likely illegal. Shame on you. It does matter how you originally acquire the material. Just because it's a fair use purpose doesn't mean you can pirate things. But you would have to purchase the albums, or if there was another site where they had purchased it and they were using it academically, you may be able to use it in that regard, but you can't illegally obtain educational material. The fact that they're stored on a password-protected site in this instance may be necessary simply because they're new songs, they're Billboard's Pop 10. By providing the whole song, there's definitely going to be a case of limiting their commercial use if you're making these freely available to anyone online. So that could be an issue you'd want to be concerned about. And the fact that it's an educational purpose, then the asterisk there is the publishers, the record companies, movie companies have begun requesting a backdoor access to course password-protected sites. because they're concerned that hanky-panky might be going on back there. And to date, they haven't gotten very far, but they're certainly pursuing that. So that's something to keep in mind. And really, password protection is, a lot of places seem to use it because they're not sure if something's fair use. And so if they can just protect it and no one knows, then, you know, maybe they'll be all right. But that's not really an appropriate application of fair use as much as protecting it just for commercial interests. So I wouldn't get in a habit of just, I'm not sure what this is, so we'll just put a password on it so no one knows. And then lastly, what about Google? An image of Simpsons character Ned Flanders is acquired through a Google search and posted on the homepage and saved to the server of a university's Center for the Study of Religion in America. The fact that it's a Google search, not really that much of an issue. The assumption would be that whoever you obtained it from either owned the material or you know, is using it for some fair use purpose in and of themselves. May be an issue if you're saving it to your server. The fact that it's for a course is useful. You'd want to make sure that it's relevant to actually the dialogue of the course. A lot of people like to go through the internet and find fun pictures that, you know, make their page exciting, but really don't all oftentimes have a lot to do with the actual content. And that's, making something pretty isn't necessarily an academic fair use argument. So it'd be important to make sure that what you're using has that educational purposes. Question? The question was, you know, if I get this right, that if you have an issue comes up with the DMCA and you're sent notice to take it down, what's involved with that?
Let's say you've done something which actually is a problem.
Okay.
Are you liable for that at that point, or is it not until after you've been notified and not taken it down for which you which time you're
Okay, so the question is, if you've been notified that someone believes you've done something incorrectly and they want you to take it down, do you have to, and what are the ramifications of that? I mean, it all goes back to sort of the argument, and if you think you can make a good argument that it is fair use, keep it up. And if you think that, you know, they give you some evidence that you think strongly says, well, maybe they might have a good argument for this not being fair use, I'll just, you know, could be either way, so I'll just be safe and take it down. And it's really not going to be decided until it enters into the into court. And they may look at the fact that you, if you kept it up and it impacted the commercial, you know, ramifications of having that available, that might become an issue because it would increase the impact that it might have on the original creator. But aside from that, not being a lawyer myself, I probably shouldn't say much more. Yeah.
I'm interested in if a school has posted something and it is clearly in violation.
Okay.
Is and then receives a notification to the account and does.
Yes.
The period of time until the request to take down was sent, is during that period can there be action taken? Or is it only after you've been notified and chosen to leave it up that the clock starts ticking?
The question was, so you've been notified to take something down and it clearly is a violation of fair use, can you be liable for having it up in the first place and liable for the amount of time it's up before you take it down? Perhaps. I mean, you've definitely got that sort of shield, sort of protecting universities where, you know, they're not likely to be taken to court because it looks bad, there's not necessarily a lot of commercial interest, and We looked at, you know, some of those things we looked at earlier. So those would all be issues. But, you know, if they can make a case that they were severely impacted by having that available, then, you know, it could be a strong case for putting it up in the first place. So you're not just generally protected from posting things and doing so until you receive a notice, but the fact that you do it is more the issue. So I wouldn't say that it's okay to post things until you receive a notice, but it's more the act of doing the posting in general that's more the issue. So that, did that answer that? It's about all I can tell you.
It's the YouTube issue. It's the fact that YouTube is saying, well, there's millions of copyrighted things here. We have been notified by FTC to take it down. As soon as they do, we'll take it down. But until that time, you have to tell us first. And I'm aware of an institution that was covered in the New York Times that was making a decision about whether or not to post the entire New York Times article on their site and then wait on the New York Times to tell them to take it down.
Yes.
For the same rationale as the YouTube, and they posted the DMCA agent very clearly, so it's like, yeah, come after us.
Yeah.
Until you do, we're going to take it up.
And some people like to work that way, you know. Well, we'll do it, and just send us the cease and desist if you don't like it. You know, and sort of use the sort of internet protective bubble as a way to, you know, sort of flaunt that, but I don't really, you know, I think in those cases they're really trying to move, you know, the law one way or the other rather than really seeing if they're, you know, following it as it exists. Yes.
It's maybe outside your realm in a way, I don't know, but following along the same line here. Is the copyright holder required to notify the infringer, or can the first time you hear about it be a subpoena?
The question was, can the first time you know about a possible infringement, do you have to be notified or by the actual user, or can they just, you know, notify you via subpoena? And I don't know the answer to that. I would assume that a subpoena would work just fine. So I wouldn't say that, you know, that it'd be nice of them to notify you. And if they want to make a, you know, valid case, it may be helpful for them to notify you beforehand and give you the opportunity to take it down. And it'd make them look favorable, you know, to the courts because they're being nice. But I don't think it's necessary. Last piece for this, and then we'll move on. There's also a thing called trademark fair use, which is a completely different animal from copyright fair use, and I'm not going to say anything about it other than mentioning it. But if there's things that may be trademarked, you'd want to look into that a little bit more carefully if you're posting content like that. And then also, I'll just throw out someone when I first gave this, asked me, So is it fair use for you to use a picture of Ned Flanders in your presentation? And I think that it is, and I went through the four prongs with them, and, you know, it's, as far as the scope of the Simpsons work, it's a small image. I am, you know, talking about how the image as itself is being used in relation to how it would be implemented on a website, so it's helpful to see an image for that. I took this picture off of Google, where I assume someone else took it off of a DVD they owned. I also own several Simpsons DVDs. So, and we're an, you know, educational conference. I'm providing you knowledge about copyright law. So I think I'd have some pretty good arguments for using his picture. And likewise with the book and movie thumbnails, they're small and not really representative of much of the work. And I used more to, you know, give a foundation for what I'm talking about than for art or fun. So I'd say I'd have a fairly good argument, but the question is, how do we know with certainty when a use is fair? When the judge tells you. So it's kind of the lawyer joke, but it's also very true. It's because of that ambiguity that, you know, you won't know for sure until you're told. So is there an alternative to all of this? The Creative Commons. How many of you are familiar or use Creative Commons licenses? All right. It's been about half for most of these, so that's kind of cool. So basically how it works is if you see fair use as kind of a defense for using some work, Creative Commons is sort of a more forward, preventative kind of solution to controlling how work is used. And Creative Commons doesn't negate your ability to use fair use, but it kind of makes the process a little easier for both parties. Because you can sort of define ahead of time ways that people can use this material without having to apply the fair use process. So if you say, well, you know, I would have no problem with someone using this non-commercially, you can give it a non-commercial Creative Commons license, and then, you know, any institution doesn't have to worry about, you know, the other issues related to copyright law, because they already have non-commercial permission to use it. So those can be very helpful, and again, they don't trump fair use, they're just sort of an added additional way to sort of add functionality to copyright law, which basically doesn't say much other than someone made this and it wasn't me. So attribution I want to talk about just briefly. Attribution is basically just giving credit to whoever created it, and the license says that you provide attribution in the same manner in which the work was originally attributed. So if someone has a picture and the source code says this picture was by so-and-so, then you would have to, if you reuse that image, include that whoever created it in the source code. If they have their name watermarked diagonally across the middle of the image, you have to keep that there as formal attribution because that's how it was originally presented. So just something to keep in mind if you want to reuse other things. So like Flickr, we'll look at a little bit later, they offer Creative Commons licenses for images, and they don't tell you how you're supposed to do that, and you basically just do it however the person has done it. So you'd want to include, you know, their profile identity, and then, you know, see if they've attached anything else to that. Non-derivative basically means that you can't alter what you're using. So if you take a photo, you can't crop it, you can't, I mean, you manipulate it in any way without additional permission. Share alike basically says that if you're reusing something, whatever you're building has to have the same license of the work you're borrowing from. So it's kind of a nice way to promote other people using Creative Commons licenses. Then we've also got the GNU General Public License, and this is primarily for software. Those of you that are familiar with Linux probably know a lot about how this works, but it sort of responds to the DRM problem by saying that, you know, programs should be released with a freedom to study how it works, adapt it, redistribute it, all those sorts of things. I won't spend too much more time with that. So content resources. This is just a brief list of some places you can go to for Creative Commons public domain resources. So if you don't want to have to bring fair use into the argument, you can start with these places and see what you find. Particularly useful is Flickr. And if you Google Flickr Creative Commons, you'll come up with a page that allows you to filter your search results by one of a number of different Creative Commons licenses. And Flickr just has some cool stuff. And I found it very useful. And you know, even if it's not licensed, I've had fairly good luck in just contacting the creator and saying, would you mind if I use this way? How would you like to be credited? And that's an option. I mean, you know, you can always just contact the individual if you're concerned about whether your use would fall under fair use. Video isn't as quite as far along in terms of Creative Commons things as images, at least from what I've found. There's a lot of public domain material available that tends to be, you know, prior to the 1930s. Software, SourceForge is kind of the big repository for open source programs. By the way, my presentation was done in OpenOffice, which is an open source office suite. It isn't quite as handy as PowerPoint. I was limited in a few ways, but it's doing the job right now. but their Word and spreadsheet applications are pretty good. And then lastly, some web-specific programs. GIMP is an image editor very similar to Photoshop. The one limitation would be they don't have a lot of fancy things you can do with layers like Photoshop does, and it doesn't come with a lot of the filters. You can do those things, but you'd have to kind of trial and error your way through applying the filter manually rather than the little sliders and fun tools that Photoshop comes with. But if your school is limited to, like, we have licenses for Photoshop for web staff and the communications, but regular staff and faculty don't have their own personal copies of Photoshop, you can send them GIMP and they can, you know, color correct and crop their own pictures before sending it to you, so it's how they want it to look. So it's something nice that you can kind of pass along to them. PHP Designer, just a pretty simple PHP editor. Has HTML, CSS. I use it quite a bit. And then Xenu is really cool. It is a link checker. So if you've got a page that you've removed or changed the link to, you can run this tool and it'll go through your site and identify any other pages that link to that, and also identify any broken links you might have. So it's very useful if you want to, you know, we usually comb through our site a couple times a year and just see if there's anything that's no longer, if there's a link broken, and we can fix that. And very handy. And lastly, I'll just give a couple further resources if you want to study for use more in depth. Wikipedia's got some really good information, particularly the two articles from the Harvard Law School Berkman Center were very helpful in setting this up, particularly the first one, Digital Rights Management and the Process of Fair Use. I suggest you all read if you're interested in this issue. What they do is they take four sort of situations that are currently happening in different academic settings where fair use and copyright law and DRM have become an issue. What I'll talk about is a film course where it just doesn't work to set up five DVDs all queued up to certain clips in a movie. And so the professor basically said, well, you know, fair use gives me the right to reuse content, so I could care less about DRM, and he just went ahead and overrode the anti-circumvention methods and took his clips and put them on a course site, and it just kind of details, you know, the pluses and minuses to that, and kind of talks about those issues from a legal perspective. And I think they would definitely be ones in favor of reducing the restrictions of DRM, and even going as far as to say that in some instances they don't apply to fair use, even though they say they do. And then also the Electronic Frontier Foundation is a great place to see like news and recent things that are happening with the DMCA and sort of how it's affecting things on the web and whatnot. So check those out. I'd like to thank Professor Jennifer Jenkins from the Duke Law Center for the Study of the Public Domain, who kind of worked through some of this with me and answered some questions. And then likewise, Kevin L. Smith, who is sort of the copyright lawyer for the, I think, curriculum as a whole for Duke University. So just sort of make sure that everything's kosher that's going on there. And they actually had slightly different perspectives on the relationship between fair use and digital rights management. So I'm glad I talked with both of them. That's me and where you can contact me, and I'll answer any questions you might have. Yes?
What's your opinion on, in our department, we do a lot of human relations as well.
Yes?
And one of the procedures we have is set up recently is to actually visually, you know, pull in a cable feed to local news stations for clips about, like, the first report done. We take it, we edit it out, and things here we're in DVD. And really, right now, the idea is just to give that to our executive committee and also to support our goals. How, A, is that a really bad idea? And B, how far or how much could we repurpose that content for?
Yeah, so the question was, they're taking clips from various television and cable news sources and repurposing those and putting... Are you putting it online?
Yeah,
just on a DVD? Okay, they archive it and then put it on a DVD and distribute that to...
Executives.
Yeah, just executives. So with that, I mean, there may... a couple issues. One is whether there's any contract with those particular news sources, and you know, if they're just kind of showing up and doing a story, probably not. If you're saying, hey, come on by, we've got this stuff going on, then you know there may be some type of contract involved with that. But the fact that you're limiting the distribution, that it's for an educational purpose of, you know, showing this executive board what's been happening, and the fact that you're a university, I'd say there's strong arguments there for fair use. It would depend, I guess another issue would be how you're acquiring it, you know, since it's cable, you know, if there's any sort of decryption going on or things like that, that it might be being sent as could be an issue, depending on which side of the fair use DRM argument you'd want to fall on. But also know that you're protected by the, you know, fair use academic sort of buffer. So, you know, worst case, yeah, I'd think you'd have a fairly good argument, but don't know until you ask the judge. So, it's front row?
Yes. My laboratory is funded by the Department of Energy, and frequently we've found the content that we create upon other sites. Now, being funded by the government, statement that I see in the contract says that the rate is accessible basically to the public because it's funded by the government. You know, what would the issues be with the reuse of that content? Is it just kind of up for grabs?
Yeah, the question was they're working with a government organization in producing content, and they've noticed the content appearing on other sites and wanted to know what issues are involved with that. And yes, if it, in general, if it's, you know, produced by the government or funded by the government or there's taxpayer money involved, generally that's going to be not so much copyright but public domain. And if it's public domain, then it's fair game. And you can do whatever you want with it. Yes?
So is there any point to putting a copyright at the bottom of the web page?
Nope. I mean, you can. It's fun. But you don't need to. And if you, you know, don't see one, don't assume it isn't. However, I would recommend putting a Creative Commons license on your page if you want to sort of specify or give suggestions or limit how, you know, other people may want to use it, be a good idea. Yes?
Fair use, you see on web pages a lot that the content cannot be used without the author's express permission.
Yes.
Is that basically, is that fair use that you cannot use it at all, or is fair use still from that?
The question was if the author of the work has a disclaimer that says you can't reuse this content, does that trump fair use? No. That trumps commercial use, but it would not trump fair use. The assumption would be that it's just copyright and you can say whatever you want, but fair use is your right to, you know, supersede copyright without permission in certain instances, and we saw that earlier, so they can disclaim all they want. Oh.
I just have another question about websites.
Yeah, good question. The question was, what exactly is copyright in a website? Is it your source code? Is it your images? Is it the content? Yes. Yes. Copyright is basically, you know, once you create it, it's copyright. So once you create the code, copyright. Once you create the content, copyright. The one exception is, I think, with films. They're not copyright until they're shown. So until it's presented, so you could create something and just have it on your hard drive, and that would technically not be copyright until it's actually presented. I'm not really sure a lot about why, but yeah, so that's kind of an exception. Yes?
My question is, we have a lot of exposures
The question was, there's some faculty members and lecturers that are using sort of Dilbert and Farside cartoons and graphs from books in their presentations, and is that for use? And then also, if they publish those online, the presentation files on the website, is that, you know, fair use? And I mean, it really comes down to how they're being used. I mean, if it interacts with the content, if it's, you know, teaching something, you know, then that'd be an argument for fair use. If it's severely impacting the marketability of, you know, where the cartoon came from, then that's an argument against fair use. Most likely, since it's only one, you know, cartoon, it's not going to have a huge impact on, you know, selling a book of Farside cartoons. So that'd be one of the commercial issues. Or with the book, with the graph, if it, you know, was one of the main charts that described exactly, you know, summarized what the book was talking about, you know, that might be a factor over whether it was just one of many graphs or charts. So there's no yes or no. A judge could tell you if that was fair use. But just being for an academic presentation and whatnot, I think you'd have a strong fair use argument.
My understanding at one point there was a vote of legislation to basically clarify fair use. Have you heard about that? And do you know what's happened there?
The question was that I've heard that there's been some work to sort of more define what fair use is and limit that. And do I know anything about that? I don't think I know anything about that. I've come across some things dealing with fair use, but I don't think quite along those lines. Most of what I've seen has been related to the DMCA stuff, and that might be what it was referring to, because that does limit fair use, and it has sort of defined in a more limited fashion what fair use, or tried to define in a more limited fashion what fair use can do. But to my knowledge, they're not rewriting fair use. Yes?
I'm from the marketing side of the university, and I'm seeing a lot of usage for memes, that cartoons or whatever in alumni newsletters that are much more promotional and they're not really educational. Are the courts really ruling that any activity of an educational institution is education? Or are they starting to identify that there's some things that universities do that really are commercial?
Question was, there's alumni publication and things that have a very marketing edge to them over what might be considered an academic edge, and at what point is something more likely to be a concern in terms of whether it's a commercial use. And like we mentioned earlier, just because you have the .edu doesn't give you the right to just do whatever you want. At the same time, you know, and part of the reason why there weren't actual cases, and I had hypotheticals, is because there haven't been a lot of cases of educational fair use cases going to court. I mean, there's hardly any. So that's something to keep in mind. Whether yours is really academic, I mean, that's kind of for you to really make the determination of. If there's a commercial interest involved, I would really question the need for some of those things. I know a lot of times it's just someone going, hey, this is kind of funny, we'll throw that in, it'll be good, but, you know, it's not always, if it's not part of the core of what you're presenting, you know, you may want to question whether, you know, it's really necessary or appropriate if there's, you're concerned about the commercial aspects.
Start to use something that, you know, as far as educational purposes or
to start getting fuzzy? Do you know how to, if you're alluding to, kind of does, do you have to copyright something for perhaps a potential international usage?
Yes, the question was, how does this apply internationally? So their campus has several schools outside of the country, and how does their content, how is it affected in those areas? And I guess I should have titled this Understanding Fair Use in America. I don't know that I'm by any means qualified to answer that. The copyright Berne Convention that we looked at is an international law. That doesn't mean that every country abides by it or follows it, and the U.S. didn't for a very long time. So it would depend on the country. I know that, well, in what I've read, it seems that fair use is mostly, it's not as popular in other areas as it is in America. Like, it's very, very much an American kind of philosophy, and it's not found a lot elsewhere. But I think if you look at the Wikipedia articles on fair use and copyright law, they'll have a lot of information about how it applies in other countries. So it might be something to look at. I think we're out of time. Thank you.
We wanted to make one quick announcement here.